content of the lecture then. We will continue today talking about quantitative research, and this is our last, let's say, theory-focused research, theory-focused lecture. Next week, next Monday, we will start taking all this thing together that we have gone through in the three first lectures, and I'll demonstrate you a research project. So we'll take a hypothesis from a published paper, and then we'll go through how we would actually go about testing the hypothesis, do the analysis, and then you can see how it's actually done. So this far we'll be talking about theory, and we'll continue a bit more about theory. So today our topic is regression analysis, which is the workhorse of quantitative research. Almost any analysis approach that you may do is either a special case of a regression analysis or an extension of regression analysis. So if you know how to do regression, you would probably be able to write half of the published information systems research papers because the tool is so widely used. Last lecture we covered two important topics related to quality of quantitative research. We talked about reliability of data and validity of measurement. Why do you think the reliability basically means whether if someone else were to replicate the study, would they get the same result? Or was the result just a chance occurrence? Why do you think that reliability is simply a feature of data in quantitative analysis? Any ideas? Why reliability is only about data? Any clues? Why is it not about analysis? Well, if you run a regression analysis or a factor analysis to the same data over and over and over, you will always get the same exact result because we use computers and they are reliable. So the only source of unreliability is our data. And ideally, we have documented our procedures so well that if anyone else wanted to replicate the study, they could do exactly what we did. Most papers report their procedures with that accuracy. The validity, or measurement validity, or some people like to call it construct validity, refers to whether the variables in our data actually measure the things that we say they do measure. For example of a valid measurement would be a result of an IQ test that may be a valid measure of your intelligence. It is not perfectly reliable. An invalid measure, but highly reliable measure of intelligence would be the circumference of your head with a measurement tape. You always get the same result over and over, but the result doesn't really tell you what you want to know. It doesn't tell you much about intelligence. Of course, it correlates with intelligence because children are less intelligent than adults, and also children have smaller heads than adults. So that's perhaps the only reason why it correlates with actually intelligence. Then we have three more things that we need to have in a study for the study to be high quality. We must have statistical conclusion validity, which means that when we're identifying some kind of dependencies or differences in the data, we must have identified them correctly. So we can use our tools incorrectly and come to incorrect findings. Then internal validity refers to whether the statistical associations that we have identified are actually causal associations instead of just being spurious. For example, there may be a correlation between CEO gender and company's profitability caused by a third factor such as certain industries being dominated by women CEOs and also being more profitable without any direct link between profitability and the CEO gender. Then external validity basically refers to how generalizable your study is. And of course, generalizability of the study depends on what is your sample, what's your population. If you're studying a sample of Finnish software companies, then it may not generalize that well to bakeries in Italy, for example. So generalizability is something that you judge afterwards, and it's a subjective assessment quite often. Then we talked about reasoning. So in quantitative research, we use deductive reasoning. So the idea is that we have some kind of theory. So theory is an explanation of how, when, what, and why. And here's an example of a theoretical argument. So Venkatesh and colleagues in the paper that I gave you argue that accuracy is an important contribution to information quality. And if that is true, then we should observe that accuracy is positively related to intention to use e-government. So hypothesis is something that is a consequence of a theory. So if the theory is correct, then we should observe what the hypothesis states in the data. And theory itself is not directly testable, but hypothesis is something that we can actually go and collect data and then see if the hypothesis holds in our data. So we have the explanation of how, why, and when theory. Then we have what we should observe if the theory is correct. If the theory is correct, then we can deduce that the hypothesis must be correct as well. So that's the way we arrive into the hypothesis. And now we're going to talk about how we go about and test those hypotheses. So those of you who read the paper may know this figure one. So that's a lot of boxes and arrows. And what can you make of that figure? So what does the figure tell us? Each box here represents an operational definition of a variable. So that's the variable that the hypothesis is about. These boxes are not the construct, rather than the variables that we think measure those constructs in our statistical analysis. And then each line here corresponds to a hypothesis. So you can see that there's H1, hypothesis 1, H2, it's hypothesis 2. And then we can also see that we have this change. So information quality characteristics, we have two hypotheses that they are both accuracy and completeness are positively associated with the intention to use e-government. And then intention to use is associated with use of e-government, which is associated with satisfaction of e-government. So the idea is that we present all the hypotheses in a diagram form, which make it easy for people who understand how to read these kind of diagrams to see what the analysis is about, what the paper is about. And then we go and test this model. The easiest way to test that kind of model is go by it piecewise, for which we use a regression analysis. So for example, we first assess what are the determinants of intention to use e-government, then we test if the e-government and intention and use are associated, and if use and satisfaction are associated, would be yet another regression analysis. This figure here has a direct correspondence to most of the tables in the paper. So you can see this kind of papers, these kind of tables in most academic papers that are done with quantitative methods. So you have these variable names here. Then you have numbers here in columns. Columns have some kind of labels. And then you have one variable name up here. So this is a table of regression analysis results. And during this lecture, we will go through and see what those numbers mean. How do you interpret this kind of table? And in the next lecture, I will explain to you how to produce these kind of tables from data. Regression analysis, why it's used? Well, we have to go back to the conditions of causality. Oftentimes, when we find some kind of effect, difference, relationship in our data, it's not enough to say that, well, there is a correlation between use and satisfaction. We would like to argue that it's actually the use of the system that causes the satisfaction. So we have to do a causal claim instead of stating simply association. And we have three conditions: association, direction of influence, easy to establish, you measure the cause before the effect, and then the hard part, elimination of rival explanations. We can do experiments in some scenarios, but it's difficult. Therefore, we use statistical controlling for alternative explanations. And that is what a regression analysis does. The idea of a regression analysis is that you have one dependent variable. You have one variable that you explain with one or more independent variables. These go with different names, but I think the independent variable, dependent variable are the most common. The objective of the analysis is to explain the dependent variable as well as possible using the independent variables. For example, referring back to the CEO gender example, we could explain return on assets with gender, firm size, and industry. So we could formulate a model, which is just an equation, that return on assets is a sum of beta zero intercept plus beta one, CEO is female, beta two, firm revenue, beta three is manufacturing firm, plus some part that we can't observe. And these betas here are called regression coefficients. So we try to express the dependent variable as a linear function of the independent variables. This will tell us how large effect one variable has on the dependent variable when we take the other variables into account. We control for the other variables. Regression analysis is simple to understand with the Venn diagram presentation. So here we have performance, that will be the return on assets, Y. Y is often used for the dependent variable, and X is often used for the independent variable in regression analysis. So we have gender, we have company size, and we have performance. We can see that the area here, the overlap between X and Y is their correlation. So X and Y are statistically associated. Now, we can also see that firm size is statistically associated with gender because these circles overlap, and firm size is statistically associated with performance because there's overlap. And there is also some degree of association between all these three variables. What we want to do with the regression analysis is that we want to answer the question, how much of this association here is uniquely due to X? So we want to eliminate the effects of company size on the difference. So we want to we ask basically the question, after we take the size differences, industry differences, whatever into account in our data, do we still have an effect of CEO gender on the performance of a company? If we do, then we know that it is not because of size or some other alternative explanation, but we can infer that maybe there is a causal relationship. So basically how regression analysis works is that when we have a control variable, we kind of take a bite away from the pie. So we eliminate that part of the shared variance between X and Y that is also shared with the control variable. And when we have more and more controls, we can take another bite, then eventually what is left is the unique effect of gender on performance that cannot be explained by any third variable. So we have to think about all the plausible alternative explanations, include those in the same model, and see what is uniquely explained by gender. So the important thing about regression is that it's a tool that we can use to include control variables in our analysis. It is like a correlation, except that correlation is a measure of linear dependency between two variables. Here we have more than two variables, out of which one is dependent, others are independent. Regression analysis with just one independent variable is the same as correlation. So you get exactly the same result. So control variables were the alternative explanations for the association between our dependent variable that we are studying, an independent variable that we think that explains the dependent variable that we want to study. So these are driven by theory. What other plausible explanations you can come up with, then you have to document those explanations in your master thesis or research paper or whatever you're writing. Regression analysis can also be expressed graphically in another way. So we can have one independent variable and one dependent variable. And regression analysis, if we think about just one independent variable, here we have education is the independent variable, education and prestige. These data come from a government census from Canada, and they're about occupations. And the data tell us what is the prestigious of an occupation, how much education on average it requires to enter that occupation. And we can use regression analysis to answer the question, how are prestige and education related? And regression in this two-variable case, it basically, you can think of it as a first drawing a scatter plot of all the observations, and then drawing a line through the middle. So you are trying to explain the data with one linear trend that explains the data as well as possible. How we find the line is that we have the concept of fitted value and we have the concept of residual. So the concept of fitted value is basically we have the regression analysis model here. So y is the prestige here, x is the education. And fitted values are this line. So basically, given 12 years of education, how prestigious profession can you, how prestigious can you expect the profession to be? Or, on average, how prestigious are those occupations that take 12 years of study to get into? So that is the amount of prestige that our model predicts. And if we observe an actual value of prestigiousness here that is a bit off the line, then the difference between this observation and the line is called residual. So residual is the part that the model doesn't explain. And the residual, how we find the line is that we take squares, we raise each residual to the power of 2, we take a sum, and then we find a line that minimizes the sum of squared residuals. That is called ordinary least squares estimator, or ordinary least squares regression analysis. And this simple principle is behind most of our analysis tools. So why do we want to use regression analysis instead of just using correlations? One of my favorite books on regression, Woolrich's Introductory Economics, Econometrics, states that the power of multiple regression analysis is that it allows us to do non-experimental research where we still control for things by keeping other factors fixed. So we are saying that after eliminating all differences due to control variables, do we still have an effect? That's basically what the regression analysis does. Regression analysis gives us regression coefficients. We'll be looking at an example soon. So we find a model that explains, for example, return on assets, and we interpret the model by looking at each coefficient individually. So, for example, here, the interpretation would be that holding other variables, meaning firm revenue and whether it's a manufacturing firm constant, one unit increase in CEO is female is associated with beta 1 increase in return on assets. It tells us what is the effect of one variable on another. So that is, it's simple. But what does it mean that you hold things fixed? So that is something that people have difficulties in understanding because it's a bit technical explanation. Another way of thinking about the regression analysis interpretation is that if we have two companies of the same size and same industry, then a woman-led company is on average beta 1 more profitable. And beta 1 is the regression coefficient given to you by your regression software. So here is an example again of the regression table. Now we'll start to look at what this table actually tells us. So the idea of regression was to find a line that best describes the data, and the idea of what you include in the variable is driven by your theory, and then controls whose influence you want to control for or eliminate from the analysis. And Each of these columns here is one regression analysis. So they have three regression analyses in the table. All of those variables have the same dependent variable. So they have here, it's listed either here about the variables, or it's listed in the table tile. So here they have regression analysis predicting intention to use e-government. So their dependent variable in the table is intention, and they are using two different samples. And the two different samples, one is from government website, another was from some other setting. And this is just the first half of the table. The idea of having, let's just focus first on the first model. So in this model, they only have the control variables. So they're asking the question of, for example, how much income is associated with intention to use e-government when we control for gender, age, education, need for government service, and government staff. And they find that income is strongly associated with use of e-government services. Why may that be the case? Do you think that income per se has an effect on whether a person uses e-government services? E-government service means basically online services provided by government that you use to access government services, like Vero.fi, Kela.fi in Finland. So do you think that there is an income, actually, when you make more money, that causes you to use more e-government services? Or any alternative explanation for that relationship? So do you think if I got a raise of 500 euros per month, would I use more government services because I got the raise? Do you think? No, I wouldn't. That would have zero effect on my use of e-government services. So why do we have a significant regression coefficient, a large regression coefficient? Any ideas? Is there a third variable, third factor that may cause both income and how much I use e-government services? Age. But age is controlled for already. Any others? Where I live. So are you saying that if I live in a, for example, city, I make more money than if I live in a countryside? And if I live in a city, then I'm more likely to be using e-government services than when I live in a countryside. Yeah. I think maybe it works the other way around. So the people who live on the countryside are more likely to use e-government services. So this, what the model actually means, yeah. If you're unemployed, you use more government services. If you're unemployed, you make less money. So we should have a negative relationship. But here we have a positive relationship, 0.23. Well, we have no idea of knowing. My first guess was that they're measuring education, and they have measurement there. So maybe that doesn't really capture education as well as it could. And maybe it's just that more educated people earn more money and are more likely to use e-government services. And their measure of education doesn't fully capture that. So regression analysis allows us to control for alternative explanation, but it's not perfect. So there still may be some effects that we can't control for. Here, the interpretation of this, for example, internet self-efficacy. And internet self-efficacy, when it increases by one standard deviation, then it means that the intention to use e-government increases by 0.23 standard deviations. Is it a large effect? So that's the first thing that when we see our regression analysis, or actually the third thing, but the first in this lecture is that we ask, is it a large effect? Is it a meaningfully large effect? So is standard deviation, first of all, if someone is one standard deviation larger, greater, richer, better, worse, is it a big difference? One standard deviation. How much is, do you have any idea how much standard deviation of height of adult men are? So it's about 7 centimeters. And that's useful way of quantifying how much a standard deviation is. If someone is 7 centimeters taller than I am, they are one standard deviation taller, and that would be a noticeable difference, but it wouldn't be like he's a giant and I'm a dwarf. So it's a noticeable difference, but it's not a huge difference. And if we think that someone's internal chest efficacy increased by one standard deviation, then use of government services increased by 0.23 standard deviations. That is a fairly substantial effect. Interpretation of this regression coefficient is difficult because you have to contrast it with your theory. There is, fortunately, other things that you can also look from the table than simply look at the coefficient. One thing are the stars. So the stars here are results of a null hypothesis significance test. We covered that in the first lecture. So those are tests against the null hypothesis that the coefficient is zero in the population. And the stars denote p-values. Usually we use the stars because it's easier to read than having the p-values printed in the table. And then we have the legend here that tells us what the actual p-values are. So getting this kind of 0.23 difference, when there is no difference really, getting that kind of result by chance only would be less than in one in 1,000. So it's quite unlikely that we would get that kind of result by chance only. So when you look at the regression table, the first thing that you may look at are the stars. If there is no star attached, like there is no star on income, then we can conclude that income probably doesn't have a meaningfully large effect that we should interpret. And we can just ignore that regression coefficient. So the stars tell us p-values. And the important part when you think about the results is answering the question, is the effect large? To answer that question, it is useful to look at what's here in the table footer here. So we have the table footer. We have these, we have the regression models here, the variables that go into the model, and we have here something called R square. And R square statistic tells us how much of the dependent variables, all the independent variables explained together. So here we can see it's basically when we look at the Venn diagram. It basically tells us what is this total area here, compared to the total area that these two variables explain out of performance. If R square is zero, it means that the variables in the model don't explain the dependent variable at all. If R square is one, then it tells that the regression model explains the dependent variable perfectly. The R square values in information systems, when we talk about people and information systems, they are in the 20% ballpark, typically. You may see 30%, 10%, 5%, depending on what is the phenomena that we're studying. So in social sciences, in social life, but it's very difficult to perfectly explain anything. So we explain like 10%, 30%, 40%. And when we add more things to the model, then we always explain the dependent variable better and better. Then we have, the next one is adjusted R square. And R square in small samples, it tends to be a bit too large. So the regression analysis overestimates how much of the dependent variable we can actually explain. And the adjusted R square adjusts for that overestimation. So if you see a regression analysis, then it's usually a good idea to look at the adjusted R square. Here we have a large sample size, so adjusted R square and R square are about the same. Then about the estimation or modeling strategy. So we want to answer the question of this gender and performance example. We want to answer how much of the performance differences is due to the gender after controlling for company size. And that question can be recast into another question. And the other question would be how much size explain of the dependent variable. Then a follow-up question would be how much size and gender explain together the dependent variable. The difference between those two numbers is the amount of the dependent variable that gender explains uniquely. And that is a useful rule to remember when you try to interpret regression models. That's exactly what these guys are doing. So we have the first block here is the control variables only. So we have the things that we want to control for, eliminate their influence from the results. And then we run another regression model where we add the variables that we're interested in. Here they were interested in information quality characteristics, channel characteristics, and means of uncertainty reduction. Then we ask ourselves, does the model with the interesting variables explain the data better than the model with the controls only? And they found out that the R square increases by 0.23. So we get 23 percentage points more explanation when we add the study variables. Another way would be to say that the model with the study variables here explains the data three times as well as the model with the controls only. So yeah, we got a result here. We can't attribute the effects to the controls because the controls don't explain the data nearly as well as the controls and the study variables. So when you interpret the regression analysis, you basically look at three things. When I start reading a table, I want to first have a feasibility check. Should I read the table at all? I look at the R square. If the R square is zero, then that means that none of the independent variables really explain the dependent variable. And there is no information in the model, so I can, unless the non-explanation is an interesting thing, which it rarely is. That means that I can just skip and go on and do other models or read other papers. The second thing that I look at is the p-values. So if one of the coefficients has a large p-value that is closer to 1 than 0, then it means that getting that kind of effect by chance only would be plausible. Because I cannot rule out chance as an explanation, then it probably doesn't. It's probably not a good idea to interpret that regression coefficient too much. Then I will look at, okay, individual coefficients that have a small p-value, what do these actually mean for me? So I look at the sign and the magnitude. I could say that, well, out of the two channel characteristics, convenience is a lot more important for these people than personalization. And I kind of agree. So if I think about the government service, it makes sense that for me, a good government service is something that I don't have to spend much time with. Everything else is basically secondary. The faster I can do my taxes online, the better. I don't really care if it's personalized to me or not, as long as it contributes to being faster and more convenient. It may be that personalization helps in making things more convenient, which certainly is the case with tax returns. How many of you do your taxes online? Yeah, so it's personalized for you. Your tax information is filled in, but you don't really value the personalization per se. You value the convenience and speed that it helps you to, that it gives you. When you have a nice regression analysis result, you have large R square, you have lots of small p values, and you have lots of large effects. Unfortunately, that is never enough. So when you have a nice model that you would like to report, then you also have to do certain diagnostics for the model, because these statistical techniques, they always require some kind of assumptions. Like recall from the five qualities of a quantitative study, there is the statistical conclusion validity. You can make nice and invalid conclusions if you don't use your tools appropriately. And that relates to assumptions and diagnostics. So regression analysis assumes a set of certain things. If those things hold for your data, then regression analysis will work perfectly. If those things will not hold for your data, regression analysis may still give you nice results and good results that are trustworthy, but you should still be know what is the magnitude of the problems. So when we think about a bivariate regression, regression analysis with one independent variable, one dependent variable, here we have, for example, from Woolridge's book, we have just y and x. The idea of regression analysis is that you draw a line through the data. And the observations should be distributed around that line, the actual observations, so that they're clustered closer to the line and there are only a few observations far from the line. And that is that means that the dependent variable should be normally distributed around the regression line. Also, regression analysis assumes that the variables here on the left side are equally close to the regression line than on the right side. If that assumption doesn't hold, then your p-values may be too large or too small. These are something that after you run a regression analysis, you must diagnose and check. You cannot diagnose all assumptions, but those that you can, you must. And the full set of assumptions is here. And one of the most important assumptions are that all relationships in your data must be linear. So regression analysis fits a line to the data, basically. If your data are better explained by a curve, then a regression analysis is not the right tool for you in most cases. You should rather use an analysis that fits a curve instead of a line. Then regression assumes that observations are independent. If you take a sample of students at the school, they are independent. If you take a sample of students from the school and one student answers 10 times, then the answers from that student are not independent. Oftentimes, that's something most people don't have to worry about that. All variables must bring new information to the model. So if we have two variables that are perfectly correlated, for example, we have person's height in centimeters, person's height in inches. We cannot use those in regression analysis because we cannot say which one of those two completely overlapping variables actually explains the dependent variable. Then we have assumptions about the error term that I'll go through in the next couple of slides. How we diagnose this, how we do the diagnostics for these models is normally that we estimate the model, and then we take the residuals, the part that the model doesn't explain, and we analyze the residuals. We will go through an example in the next lecture. I will just explain the assumptions now that can be tested. The first assumption was that all relationships are linear. So on the left-hand side, we can see that there's a linear relationship between education and prestige. So a line explains the data pretty well. On the right-hand side, we can see that there is education and prestige are actually related as a curve. So education doesn't really increase the prestige in the beginning, and then it starts to rapidly increase. For this kind of, the diagnostics that you normally do after regression analysis would tell you that there is a problem of this nature, and then you can do something to fix it. Use another model instead of regression analysis. Then another thing that you can diagnose is whether the error term, the part that the model doesn't explain, has equal variance given any values of independent variables. So this is called, in regression books, this is called the homoscedasticity assumption, and violation of that assumption is called heteroscedasticity. You don't have to know those terms. What you have to understand is that it means that your variables should be spread out here as much as they are spread out here. So here, in the example data, we can see that the variables are spread out here about as evenly as they are here. But here we have a problem. So education, there's little variance in prestige given low education. There's large variance given high education. That would create problems for your p-values, not the regression estimates themselves. Then the final assumption that you can, yeah. You will, let's go back to the Venn diagram presentation. The control variable company size here and gender here, if you include gender itself with performance, so you have just one independent variable in your regression analysis, then that will give you how much these variables overlap. So what is the amount of correlation between the two variables. Same thing if you just include the control variable size, you will get this correlation here. If you include both, then you will get a regression coefficient that tells you how large is this area A2 here and how large is the area D here. So regression kind of like eliminates the part of the data that both variables explain, and it tells you how much uniquely size explains uniquely from gender and how much gender explains uniquely from size. So this is basically thrown away. So the answer to your question is that you get both. You get, there is, from the perspective of regression analysis, the analysis itself, the computer doesn't know which variable is a control and which one is something that you're really interested in. It just tells that what is the unique influence of each variable controlling for the other factors. Did I answer your question? Okay, so if you have any questions, just please ask me, because this is new for you, I understand, and this may be, if you haven't done anything like that, like this before, it may be challenging. So we do diagnostics, and then we were in the homoscedasticity assumption. Then the final assumption that you can test is whether the error term is normally distributed. The idea of that assumption is that when we have regression line here, there should be about equal amount of observation above and below the line, and the variables below the line should be about as far from the line than, sorry, the observations below the line should be about as far from the line as the observations above the line. And here we can see a scenario where the assumption wouldn't hold. So the error term is clearly positively skewed. So we have lots more large values of the error term than we have with the small, than we have small values. That would be not very problematic, but slightly problematic. If you have a large sample, then you don't have to care about that assumption at all. So we basically, we do diagnostics about these things. We plot the residuals with our data. We plot residuals and fitted values from the regression analysis. We look for patterns. We go through that in practice next on Monday. Then we have one additional thing that we need to look at called outliers. So regression line is set so that the sum of square residuals is as small as possible. What will happen if there happens to be one exceptional observation here, the red, the black dot? So what will happen to the regression line? We have one occupation that is highly not prestigious, that requires lots of education, really doesn't fit into the pattern. What happens to the regression line? Well, first of all, we can see what would be the residual for that observation. So the residual is the difference between the observation and the line. So this outlier value has a large residual, because the residuals are taken into consideration after raising the power of 2. That means that this has a huge influence on where the regression line goes. And if the outlier is included in the analysis, the regression line actually bends down in this case. So here, instead of explaining where the majority of observations are, our regression line is highly influenced by just one observation. This is another thing that we must diagnose. Maybe that is an error in our data. Maybe the prestige score should be, instead of being 50, maybe it should be 150. There's a zero missing or something like that. That happens. So we have to look at each at individual observations that are influential for the analysis. That is the final part of the diagnostics. So you have to do diagnostics. I will go through these in more detail with a practical example next week. Then we can do we can use regression analysis to test or estimate many kinds of models. One particular important case is interaction or curved effects. And I mentioned that regression analysis finds you a linear relationship between one dependent variable and many independent variables. We can also do nonlinear relationships with a couple of tricks. And happens that one of these tricks was actually used in the Venkatesh paper. So if you read the paper, you saw the figure 2. And this is basically, they are basically drawing regression lines plotting regression lines here. So what does this figure tell us? It tells us that on here, we have regression of intention on completeness. So they're saying that information completeness leads to intention to use. So there's a positive relationship. And then they are showing that, okay, this relationship actually depends on the transparency, such that it only, if there's high transparency, then completeness of information matters positively for intention. If there's low intention, low transparency, then it doesn't really have that large of an effect. So moderation models or interaction models test relationships where one variable, where the relationship between two variables depends on another variable. We call the the x would be the explanatory variable, y would be the dependent variable, and m would be the moderator that influences the relationship between one variable, x and y. So let's think about practical examples of where might we encounter an effect whose strength depends on another variable. Any practical examples? Let's think about exercising. So eating is related to muscle gain, but only if you also exercise. So the amount of exercise moderates the relationship between the amount of eating and your muscle gain. If you don't exercise, there is no muscle gain from eating. If you exercise a lot, then how much muscle you gain correlates highly with the amount of that you eat. So that kind of things. So we are interested in contextual effects. Under which conditions one variable influences another variable? We can hardly say that there is a universal truth to anything in social sciences, but everything happens in a certain context, and the context matters. So moderation models are interesting because they allow us to take context into account. Maybe there are relationship between CEO gender and performance actually depends on the company size, so that there is an effect for small companies, but there is no effect for large companies, or the other way around. Moderation models allow us to analyze that kind of things. And this paper by Venkatesh and colleagues, they had quite a few moderation models, moderation hypotheses. So they're using the term moderate here. They are saying that transparency moderates the relation between information quality characteristics and intention to use. And then they explain to what direction the moderation is. They have another hypothesis here. And the model here, these arrows that don't go into a box, but go to another arrow, mean that the strength of this variable, this relationship actually depends on this variable set here. So that is moderation and moderator. How it actually then works? So how can we do these things where we have a relationship in a model that assumes everything is linear, that actually depends on another variable as well? How it works that we just multiply things together. So if we are interested in the moderating effect of transparency on the relationship between completeness and intention to use, we multiply transparency and completeness together. We include completeness and transparency as explanatory variables, and then we run the regression model. Why that gives us the contextual effect or the moderator effect is easy to see if we rearrange the regression equation a bit. So we can rearrange the regression equation like that. So we can see that there is one intercept that depends on transparency, and there is one regression coefficient for completeness that depends on transparency as well. So that's one way to rewrite the same model. So that's just reorganized the same equation. So the relationship between transparency, between completeness and intention depends on transparency. We can see that from the result table as well. So they are first doing the control model only. I just took it out here so that it doesn't distract us. And then they have the relations, they have the completeness first, and transparency then, and then they have their product. Then again, we compare models. We compare, does the model with all these nonlinear effects, does it explain the data better than the direct effects only model? If it does, then we can conclude that there are some indirect effects in the model. We look at the R-squares. The R-square is 0.07 larger than in the direct effects model only, and that concludes that we have these curved effects where one effect depends on another variable. So how do we actually then interpret that result? It's interpreting regression coefficients. If you do it a couple of times, it becomes pretty easy. You just look at the regression coefficient here. Every unit increase of completeness increases the intention to use by 0.1 units in standard deviations. How do we interpret this effect, this interaction effect? It's pretty difficult to do because the magnitude of the effect of completeness on intention depends on transparency. So we cannot say that there is a linear effect because the effect varies depending on transparency. And to answer that question, we do plotting. So when something is, it's difficult for you to look through the numbers only, it's a good idea to plot the data or plot the model. And this is what the figure that I showed you a few slides back is about. So we have this regression, this explanation that they explained that following Aiken and West, we plotted the interactions by deriving separate equations for high and low conditions of predictors and test the simple slope for each of the interactions. Basically, what we do then is that we take two cases. So we have this, the model here, and we assume that transparency is at one. So that's our high value, plus one standard deviation about the mean, which is zero in this case. Then we calculate the regression model. So when transparency is high, then intensive use is 0.01 plus 0.26 completeness. Then we take transparency at minus one, we plug it in here, we got this equation. So transparency is, intensive use is 0.01 minus 0.08 completeness. Then we just plot them here. So we have the high line here and the low line here. The reason why this scale differs is that these are calculated based on raw regression coefficients and the report standardized coefficients in the paper. So we can do contextual effects like that. We run regression, then we find out that the effect of one variable on another depends on a third variable. Summary of moderations. So the steps to do moderation models is that we first take main effects only. So we only take the direct effects model. When you have a study where you want to analyze contextual effects, then you have to do three models. First, you do controls only. Then you do controls and the interesting variables. Then you do controls, interesting variables, and the interactions. Then we compare R-square values with the models. We could use F-tests to do a statistical test, but it's beyond this course. And then we do an interaction plot. We can do it by hand, calculate the fitted values by hand and use Excel, or most statistical software will do this kind of calculations for you if you know how to do it. A good starting point for mediation is David R. Kenny's website. And Jerry F. Dawson has written a nice paper about this. Another thing that these guys do besides moderation is mediation. So mediation models are models where the effect of one variable to another is transmitted through a third variable. So we have a variable M called the mediator. Did any one of you spot this kind of models presented in the Singleton and Straits book? Well, they call it intervening variable, and they explained one or two pages why these kind of models are interesting. And they are interesting because rarely, because we are oftentimes not only interested in why transparency leads to satisfaction of in e-governments, rather we are interested in explaining the mechanism or the causal process through which that happens. And we can use these mediation models to assess these like causal chains. So we can see here they have this fairly large mediation model. So accuracy here leads to transparency, leads to trust, leads to intention to use, leads to satisfaction. So we have this long chain of, if information is accurate, it doesn't in and itself lead to satisfaction, rather it occurs through these other things. Whether the model is actually correct, that is debatable, but that's what they claim. The mediation model can be presented as two regression models. So we basically have a Y that depends on the mediator and the interesting variable, and then we have the mediator that depends on the interesting variable. If there is a direct effect between the interesting variable and the dependent variable, then we call it partial mediation, because the effect goes only partially through the mediator. If there is no direct effect, then we call it full mediation. How we test this kind of models, we use regression analysis again, because that's the workhorse that we have here. And one of the most commonly used tools is so-called Barron and Kenny method, named after the guys who discussed it in 1986 in a journal paper. And the idea is first to test if the dependent variable and the interesting variable are related. If they are not related, then there cannot be mediation. If they are related, then we test whether the interesting variable and the mediator are related. If yes, then there may be mediation. And then finally, we test the association between the mediator and the interesting variable on the dependent variable. Then the mediation effect is simply the product of these two regression coefficients, these two paths here. So, and that this technique or this application of regression analysis also appears in the paper. So they are basically claiming on the right-hand side of the model that transparency leads to trust, and trust leads to intention to use. They are also saying that transparency has a direct effect on intention to use, but it mostly goes through trust. So the idea, the theoretical argument is that if government is more transparent about data, then people will trust the government more. If the people will trust the government more, they will use the government services more. And the transparency itself, when we control for the effect of trust, doesn't have that large of an effect on the intention to use. They have this elaborate regression table in the paper where they test all the mediation models, or most of them, and they present all the models in one table. So it's a bit, at least for me, it's a bit complicated to figure out which model, they refer to these as beta and C and something in the paper, which corresponds to a particular set of hypotheses. But here we can after looking at the table for a while, we can find out that they actually do the Barron and Kenny method for this relationship. So first, we have regression model one, where we regress intention to use on all these variables that we control for and trust. Transparency. So we're looking at this table first. See, that's the problem with complex regression tables. Even if you have looked at this for years and years, it's still difficult when you have too many things in the table to see which is the right model to look at. So we're looking at this model here. And we can see that transparency has a positive regression coefficient with intention to use when we don't take trust into account. The next thing is that we want to do is to assess the step two, whether transparency is related to trust. We can see that there is the same controls here, and transparency is statistically related to trust. So there may be mediation going on. And finally, we look at the model that includes both transparency and trust, and we can see that, yeah, transparency has an effect, but it's partially mediated to trust, because there's a direct effect, and there is an effect of trust as well, and transparency influences trust. So this is a partial mediation model. Okay, so regression analysis interpretation. We nearly always have to do multiple models, and then we compare. We compare models based on the R-square. How much do the models explain? If one model explains the data better than another model, then those variables that were included in the second model have effect above and beyond the first set of variables. So first include controls, then include the interesting variables and compare. Then we look at whether we have these stars. So whether we have small p-values, if we don't have the stars or the p-values are large, it means that it's plausible that that kind of effect could have happened by chance only, and we should not interpret the effect any further. Then we start to look at what is the magnitude of the effect. Standardized regression coefficients, which are reported here, typically vary between 0.10 and 0.3 or 4 in information systems papers. Of course, it depends on a lot on what we're actually studying. I will next show a couple of slides about the workflow of a regression analysis project. But any questions this far? Okay, the workflow of a project. How do you actually go about doing this kind of analysis? Or how do you go about doing a quantitative paper? The first thing is that you have to form a hypothesis that you test. And the hypothesis, as we said, is based on deductive reasoning. So we have a theory, explanation of how, when, why. Then if the theory holds, then we have a hypothesis that we should observe. So we have hypothesis. And based on that hypothesis or a set of hypotheses that we want to test, we then go on and we collect data. So we get data. It may be from experiment. It may be from observing something going on in the field. It may be from a survey, or it may be from a database that someone else has collected. So those are the four main designs in social sciences. Then we are, oftentimes our data come from different sources. And we have to somehow merge the data into one database so that we can actually manage it with our statistical software, or you can do it with Excel if you like. Then we get to know our data. If we don't know our data, then the odds for us doing something valuable with the data are pretty small. So you have to know how the variables are correlated. Are there any outlying values? So if we're studying, let's say, the use of information technology in SMEs, and we're doing a survey and we accidentally send the survey form to Tieto, for example, or F-Secure, we probably want to take the Tieto and F-Secure away from the data. So we filter the data if there are some observations that should not be there. Then we may transform the data. For example, if we have qualitative data, some people have answered like open-ended questions, we have to code them in the numbers somehow, that kind of data processing. Then we have the step of creating composite measures. Most of the information or large share of information systems research is done with surveys, where we have multiple redundant questions measuring the same construct. And how we deal with those is that we first apply a factor analysis, then we take a sum of those indicators that belong to the same factor and use that sum as a proxy or as a measure for the construct that we're studying. And that's what they did in the paper. So they are using factor analysis to see which of the indicators belong together, which may measure the same thing, which have what we call convergent validity. If indicators load on the same factor and they're supposed to measure the same thing, then we say that they are convergent valid. And also we show discriminant validity. Indicator that measures something should not load highly on other factors. So that's what they did in the paper. So the factor analysis table, the results table is about that. If multiple indicators load highly on one factor, they may measure the same thing. And after that, we can actually combine those indicators together as a sum. Combining indicators that measure two different things doesn't make any sense. The next step is that when we have the measures, that the variables that would actually go into our regression analysis, is that we do descriptive statistics and correlations. There are descriptive statistics, we look at means and standard deviation of our variables. We look at correlations. And here is the table of descriptive statistics and correlations. It is pretty complex. And why it's complex is because they have two samples. They have government website sample and online appointment booking service sample. So they have the means here, standard deviations here. Then they have reliability indices here, which we don't have to care about. And in the lower diagonal here, they have correlations. So how you read this table is that you take this line here, which corresponds to age, and then you look, okay, it's column number two, so it's variable number two. So this is the correlation between age and gender. What we look from this table, the correlations table, is we look for large correlations. We look for small correlations, like large negative correlations. And then we ask ourselves, does this correlation make sense? If a correlation doesn't make sense, then we have to start thinking like, okay, why there's a correlation? Maybe there's an error in our data. So here, for example, we would observe that we have these correlations at around 0.5, 0.4. So we would look at that correlation. We would go and see which variable it's about. So it's about completeness. And it's correlation with completeness and variable number 9, which is accuracy. So completeness and accuracy are highly correlated. Then we ask ourselves, does it make sense? Does it make sense? Completeness and accuracy are highly correlated. They are both measures of information quality. And if information is high quality, it should have both accuracy and completeness. So they should be correlated based on theory. We look at that kind of things. We also look at our main variables that we expect to be correlated and check if they are correlated. Once we have gone through and interpreted the correlations table like this, then we can actually go to our main analysis, which often case is a series of regression models. So the main analysis would be, in this case, would be a regression table. They presented 4 tables of regression results, though, so they ran maybe like 30 or so models. And when we have these regression models, we can do the tables. We're happy about the results. The next thing that we do is that we do diagnostics for the main analysis. So we do that in more detail in the next lecture, but basically we look at whether the error term is normally distributed. We look at if there's any evidence of nonlinearity. We look whether there's any evidence that the spread of observations around the regression line varies from the beginning of the line to the end of the line. Then we may do some supporting analysis. For example, it may be interesting to rerun the study using a subset of our data to, for example, test whether this result holds for men only, whether it holds for women only, whether it holds for uneducated and well-educated people only. So we may do these sub-samples, because they had large samples, they can do that. Or we can do some other supporting analysis, which basically assess some of the threats to validity that we may have, or they may assess the issue of generalizability. The workflow of a quantitative paper, basically it's starts from the preparation of research design. Research topic, research question formulation is before you choose whether you do a quantitative or qualitative study or a constructive study. Okay, any questions this far? Any things that you hope me to clarify? Next Monday, we will be we'll go through an actual analysis project, something that I've done. I'll replicate a study using my own data, and then we can see how this actually works in practice and what a statistical software looks like, how I can get from the statistical software output to these tables that I presented here. For the next time, we don't talk about the Venkatesh paper. We don't use that as an example anymore. But it's a good idea to skim through all these chapters, because we'll be talking about things that have been discussed on all of those. And that's all today, unless you have questions. You can, of course, stay after the class and ask if you have ask in person as well.